Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Jessica with Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast, and I have the pleasure of interviewing somebody very special today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Julie Merberg. I'm the president and founder of Downtown Bookworks, a children's publishing company.
Welcome to our podcast, Julie.
Thank you for having me.
So would you like to tell me a little bit or tell us, would you like to tell us a little bit about your company, and then just sort of we can go into the books that have raised our attention and brought us here today?
Sure. As I said, the company is called Downtown Bookworks. I started publishing about 9 years ago. I have 4 children. Now age 9, now age 11.
Oh my God.
20. They have a 9-year spread. Yes. But when I first started publishing, they were all kind of in the sweet spot of the books that we're publishing. And I started publishing children's books really because I kept having ideas for books that I couldn't find that didn't exist. So the company kind of grew out of my own passions and interests and what I thought would be interesting for my own kids, and also really with a mission to keep kids engaged in reading books. I was very, very worried about the advent of smartphones and iPads and, you know, what I saw as a growing obsession with screens and kids taking in their entertainment in a passive way. And I really thought, well, if we make books really cool and engaging and interactive, they'll hopefully continue to read. And also maybe we can make books that are really fun for parents to share with kids and, you know, make them want to sit down and read with their children. So that sort of summarizes the origins of the company and also the direction we went in with our books.
And I think you do very well with that. Just to highlight what the topics of your books are by topics, they are definitely high interest to both parents and children. What are some of the books that you have published? The books that you were looking for that you weren't finding as well.
Okay, so the very first books that I published, actually, I packaged for another publisher, Chronicle Books. When my oldest, who's now 20, was just a baby, I used to take him to museums when I only had one kid and not 4 and could spend a lot of time with him. We used to spend a lot of time walking around New York City where we live and going to museums, and I realized that he loved fine art. And I started looking for books for babies and little kids that featured fine art, and they didn't exist. So the first books that I conceived of that I could not find in the store were this, what became a series of Chronicle Books called Mini Masters, and they're board books that featured work by fine artists. So the first was A Magical Day with Matisse, and In the Garden with Van Gogh, and they're just like sweet little stories that feature the artist's work. And I came up with those because I used to take my my oldest, who was 2 or 3 at the time, to a lot of museums, and I realized he loved to look at fine art. And I thought, we're so fortunate, we live in New York City, we have access to all these great museums, but there have got to also be other children who can't go look at original art. So that was the origin of that idea, which then grew into a 10-book series at Chronicle. And then when I launched my own company years later, I created a similar series called Art from the Start, which teaches basic concepts to babies, but using kind of greatest hits fine art. We have a book about feelings. How is Mona Lisa Feeling, which is a book about feelings. We have Mama, Baby, and Other First Words, which is a first words book. And we have Animals and Art.
So this is all really great. And, you know, it's great to be able to share art with children and also make it accessible to children, you know, and it'll be things that they remember and they recognize as they grow. What are some other of some other books that have parent appeal, something that is shareable that with their children that you think it's appealing for a parent to share with their children?
Yeah, so art was definitely something that I felt passionately about that I wanted to share with my son. And what we've discovered as a publisher is that, you know, the more we can get parents excited about reading to kids, the more successful we can be, both in terms of having our books bought and also just having them pulled off the shelf over and over again. So we have an entire line with DC Comics, and that came about really because my husband is a huge comic book geek.
Really?
And I remember,
that's
like,
cool.
Yes. Tremendous. Our third son is named Cal, and his middle name is Lev. So Kal-El, which is Superman's Kryptonian name. Like, that's
wow. So you actually like got that. That actually happened, because I know a lot of parents, and I know Nicolas Cage actually named his son Kal-El, I believe.
We did first. We were like 6 months before Nicolas Cage. My Cal is 14 years old.
Oh, and, trendsetter.
Yeah, like, yeah, we beat Nicolas Cage with that one.
Well, because I was just going to say, I'm like, I feel like, you know, that's very clever the way that you named him. Like, Nicolas Cage could be like, I'm just going to name my son Kal-El, and people are going to say, sure. But you did a really good job of working with the pop culture name. That's awesome.
The funniest part of it is not only that my son Cal has like the Superman cowlick, but he's also a total comic book geek. Like, we'll line up at Midtown Comics on a weekly basis to, you know, get autographs from his most favorite illustrators and writers. But he's at LaGuardia High School for Fine Art, working on his comic book illustrations. So it was sort of perfect that he wound up with that name.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and kind of perfect that we wound up with an entire line of DC superhero books because of my husband's passion. And like, going home from the hospital with our first child, he turned to me and said, how long do you think before he can read comic books? And the light bulb went off, you know, because babies, of course, can't read comic books because they would shred them and eat them, that we could create board books featuring superheroes that would get, you know, the risk of sounding a little bit gendered, dads excited about reading to their kids. Obviously, there are a lot of female mom comic book fans as well. But
that
we, you
me.
Know, we really did get great. We got, a lot of parents super excited about sharing that passion with their kids. And so I went to D.C. I didn't want to license any kind of movie tie-in or animated series tie-in art. I wanted the classic comic book art that my generation had grown up reading, so that it would feel nostalgic and parents would get excited about that. And,
if you don't mind, I also just wanted to comment on it, because I have to admit that I own these. I own them myself, and I was one of the people after I saw them. I suggested that my children's department purchase them, and they're always, always, always off the shelves. And I think one of the important things to note just about the classic designs, you know, I mean, because every artist has their own style, and, you know, not to disparage, like, Alex Ross, for instance, is very, very detailed. And that's fine, and that's good. However,
like, painterly,
yes. But I guess when you're dealing with really little kids, and I mean like the ages that pick up board books, the classic designs are so simple. There's a lot of primary colors, you know. The expressions are very clear. And I think that that really is good for that age as well, who are just starting to figure things out. Like, that's really what pops. It puts the pop in pop culture of the books.
Yeah, they're very poppy and clear and clean, nothing subtle, and very bold and fun to look at. I agree. Like, you know, some of this later on, you know, a lot of the art could get darker or sketchier. So, you know, for a lot of reasons. Also, I just think it's like cool and retro looking. We do a lot of this in museum stores because everything looks so collectible.
Yeah.
But yeah, totally kid friendly.
So some of the concepts in those books, because they're not just, so talk a little bit about, so you introduce, you have your superheroes, it's the DC superhero group. Explain some of the concepts that you began to explore in them.
Well, it's funny because the evolution of the DC line really mirrors the evolution of our list. So at first, when I started out, I thought, well, we have to get books that need to be books that will make kids want to hold them and touch them. So our first DC books were my first Superman book and my first Batman book, which were interactive touch and feel books. So you could like pet furry Crypto and feel Superman's silky cape and swing Batman on the bat rope. There's even like a glow in the dark bat signal in the Batman book. So those were our first books, which were interactive and became a huge hit, like across every channel and every age group. And they, you know, they look great and they make you smile. And then from there, we then introduced Wonder Woman. So we did my first Wonder Woman book. And then we got into the concept business so that we could kind of teach through the lens of superheroes. So we did DC superheroes, ABC 1, 2, 3, and colors and shapes and opposites and parts of the body. And then we did like actions and things that grow, things that go. And now feelings and manners. We did even superhero sleep. And then we got political, like more recently. You know, then we did my first book of girl power, and that really, really struck a chord. It was very bold visually, and, you know, it's like this great-looking, hot pink book that a lot of people just bought, you know, a lot of grown-ups bought, just, like, leave out on their shelf. They were not, like, giving it to their kids or nieces. It was really, you know, just for display purposes.
It's a really cool book. At least the first one, because I know that it doesn't stop there.
It does not stop there. Yeah. So the first book, you know, the idea was, wow, these female superheroes are really, you know, interesting and they're great role models. And let's just sort of boil down what they do to one line that a 0 to 3 year old can sit and listen to and understand with a clear visual. And, you know, and like Wonder Woman, for example, has her lasso of truth, you know, so telling the truth is obviously, you know, a virtue that you'd want any child to aspire to.
Right.
And Batgirl's really smart. You know, she reads a lot.
Yes, so she does.
So it's like pretty easy to find a bunch of female superheroes who embodied important traits, and we put them into a book. And then from there, we started publishing for a slightly older audience. You know, we realized we'd kind of created this very loyal following, and the kids were getting older, and their parents were looking for, you know, more books for the kids as they grew up. So then we launched this whole big book upline that went a little bit deeper into individual superheroes and their origin stories and their superpowers and their tools and their arch enemies, and, you know, and also went deeper into concepts. We started publishing activity books. So we have like brain boosting activities. We have awesome activities for superheroes. We have a girl power journal. We have superhero science. We have a joke book and we have a cookbook. We just wound up using superheroes and that universe. We have a dictionary, you know, as a lens to educate and and get kids using their brains and using their hands and thinking creatively.
I think that this is it's a really good point to make, because I think in the past, you know, like people were so quick to dismiss or felt like maybe they had to dismiss a book that had a popular character on it. And that's so completely wrong for so on so many levels. Number one, it has the interest to get a child reading. Like if you're going to show a child a book with a superhero on it and they're going to, you know, grab that book and they're reading, like that's great. Number two, the superheroes and pop culture, they do have such, you know, their narrative for morals and for concepts and whatever is going on in the world, they sort of hold a mirror to that.
Yeah. I mean, when I first started the company, I obviously loved these superheroes and I loved the art and I wanted to make them part of my list. But I really thought that any licensed characters or brands would be a very small part of what we did. I thought we would be much more concept driven. And then as the line developed, I realized we could be both. We could have strong
concepts.
Right. And we could, you know, use popular characters or brands as a way to get kids excited about really substantive content that they might not otherwise dive into. Like superhero science is the perfect example. You know, a kid who might not pick up a book about natural science and experiments would pick up a book with Superman or Batman on the cover and then winds up learning a ton about physics and speed and chemistry that they wouldn't have known otherwise.
And that's really cool, because, you know, there's so many different ways to reach people, and the mythology of superheroes or just the narrative that pop culture gives us. I mean, when you think about going back to your original, you know, when you started doing things with art, I mean, it kind of lines up when you really think about it. You know, you have these artists that were popular and they brought forth feelings in people, you know, and so you were marrying that with concepts for children. And it's just another part of art, you know, a narrative, like the Superman story. You know, he wants to do right by his parents. He wants to do right by the world. You know, Wonder Woman, she's, you know, trying to prove herself, and truth is really important to her. And these are things that are universal. And if you marry it with something that's all over and, you know, you can share parent to child, it's such a great, like, connection for everybody.
Yeah, it's like a tool for engagement, really, and for learning. Like, in everything that we publish, there's a learning component. And we try to do it in a way that's, you know, visually beautiful and fun and appealing. So that, you know, if we said, hey, we have this book and you're going to learn a lot when you read it, you know, probably both the parents who would buy and the kids wouldn't be that excited. But if you just buy this, you know, great looking, fun sounding book and you're learning along the way, you know, it's win-win. And so that's what we do.
And why shouldn't books be fun? You know, I mean, they should be fun. You should enjoy it. There should be an enjoyment to reading. And just to sort of throw out there, so like some of the books, like the shape ones, you know, you have to identify the shape of Superman's emblem and like the opposites one, you have like under and over. I mean, it's really good because these are things that kids are supposed to be learning as they grow up, but they're also sharing superheroes with their parents and learning about superheroes, which is a very sweet thing.
And they're fun. Like our book of supervillains is really a book about right and wrong. So we use the villains as examples of, you know, bad choices.
Yeah.
But it's hilarious. And then we juxtapose them with the superheroes who are always doing good. You know, so it's not at all heavy-handed, but it's a fun way to learn important life lessons.
And some of the villains, I mean, you know, back in like the classic era, now they're dark, probably not appropriate for kids the age of your target audience.
Right. No, you which have to be like really careful and selective, you know, both in terms of the art and the details that you want to share.
But they were still campy. Like, I feel like back in that time, they were still campy. They were more mischievous and like outrageous and ridiculous, like the old Adam West Batman cartoon where everything was just outlandish and silly.
It's like little water guns.
Yeah, exactly.
Weapon of choice is an umbrella.
Exactly. So, you know, so it's a good place to start, but like we're not getting like gritty right away. You know,
you can
build up to that. So getting back to the first book of the girl power ones. So what super hero women have you featured in it? So you featured Wonder Woman and Batgirl, obviously.
Yeah, well, yes, and Supergirl.
Supergirl,
and,
yes.
And you know what, as much as I love the classic art and you know, and the DC characters, one major problem with that era is the void of characters of color.
Yes.
You know, and that's a real problem for us and for life. And so we try to address that by digging a little deeper and finding more obscure characters, which DC did as well. When they launched DC Superhero Girls, they elevated Bumblebee, who's African American, and Katana, who's Japanese.
I know they even gave Amanda Waller, who's usually more of a villainous character, they kind of in Superhero Girls, didn't they kind of made her a little bit less? They didn't make her villainous at all.
Right.
Actually,
that's
I think she's
ambiguity.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think she's their principal, and she's generally good. And she's African American. She's an interesting character in general, but that was something when I first saw Superhero Girls, I was like, "Huh, okay."
You know, and good that they're trying to introduce diversity, and you know, and it's tricky. It's tricky because we had actually unearthed a Native American character, but they wound up not letting us use her. But I found, you know, I found a non-white alien character that we could use. But, you know, Bumblebee is really cool. She's a scientist. We love her. We had to create art for her, though, because art from that era didn't exist because she didn't exist in the classic era. She's a newer character. So we, you know, we had to kind of envision what she would look like so that she'd be familiar to girls who knew Bumblebee from like the current iteration of DC Superhero Girls, but that she would, you know, look of the older style. And same with Katana, and we had to kind of sanitize Katana's backstory, which is really gory. A lot of beheading in Katana's original backstory, but she's also really cool. She's someone who like worked really, really, really hard to master martial arts, and that kind of, you know, perseverance is an admirable skill.
Yes, I do commend you for doing that because, you know, I mean, not only were a lot of the superhero girls, the women, like kind of like sort of like background characters. I mean, you know, you would get like, you would get a Wonder Woman, you would get like a Wonder Woman story, and you like, you know, you'd get Batgirl every now and then, but also she was Commissioner Gordon's daughter and not like always prominent. And same thing with Supergirl was, you know, is Superman's cousin, and she'd show up sometimes in that classic era. But yeah, there really were no characters of color that were around. So like, while like,
well, and you know, as you said, and prominent women, like Mera is Aquaman's wife.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, you know, it's like they were defined as their relationship to their male counterparts. You know, with that, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, with just the superheroes in general, you used a different Green Lantern. Did you use Hal Jordan? Or you, because I think John Stewart is, did you use John Stewart as a Green Lantern?
We used both.
Both,
we
okay.
used as much John Stewart as we could get art for.
Because John Stewart is Green Lantern as well, and he's African-American. And, you know, the first time
right.
I learned of him was in the old DC cartoons that they had back in, I believe it was the late 90s, early 2000s. And he's awesome. So, you know,
right.
so, you know, more Bumblebee,
right. and Green
more
Lantern,
Katana.
Like, right, and Green Lantern does work in that way where they're all, you know, they're all, like, equally important because it's all about the ring. So, mm-hmm. you know.
And what they bring to it as well.
Right, right. And also Cyborg, we elevated, and so did DC. And,
Cyborg
you know,
is awesome.
Part of Teen Titans.
Yes.
Yeah, Cyborg is also great. So, you know, we just had to kind of dig a little deeper and...
But I think I think you're making a good point though, and a good decision, because you know superheroes should belong to everybody, and it should be a diverse group, because number one, there is no one type of comic book or superhero fan. It does transcend everything.
Completely transcends, and you want especially. You know, for kids, for grown-ups too, but you just want to have characters who are relatable in every
yep.
way. You
yeah.
know, aspirational and relatable.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, this is what the next generation is going to grow up with and what they are
right.
going to remember. So I really give you a round of applause for that, because that was something that I thought was very cool when I started reading your books to my kids.
Thank you.
It was definitely recognized and appreciated.
We tried. I wish we could have taken it further, but we're still, you know, we have to work within,
yeah.
The universe of characters who exist. We couldn't make anything up.
Right.
So we tried, and thank you for recognizing that.
Beyond that, you also have another board book along those lines that I looked up and I found very interesting. First book of feminism?
Yeah, so Girl Power was our toe dip into empowerment and equality. And then I think 2016 just plunged us headlong, and so the next book that I felt compelled to write was and publish my first book of feminism for boys. So I have four sons, and I thought, you know, feminism, equality should not be completely on girls' shoulders. Like, boys can be better educated, and what better time than when they're tiny and worship their mothers, and you know, the idea of respecting women, starting with your mom, mm-hmm. is a no-brainer. So we published my first book of feminism for boys, which like honestly just wrote itself. And I found this great illustrator, Michelle Brummer Everett, who has much younger boys, and whose art is just so simple and childlike and clear that I felt that it really underscored the message of the book, which is that, you know, it's just so obvious that boys and girls are equal. And that book also, like, it takes on toxic masculinity and gendered play, you know, the idea that there aren't like boy toys and girl toys or boy jobs and girl jobs. And I did a lot of research to write it, because I didn't want it to be about, you know, what I thought feminism should be, or things that are just important to me, but also about, you know, things that are kind of universally known and understood and held as important. And I learned things like girls do more chores than boys naturally, and that boys expect to be paid for chores. So I addressed that idea, you know, like,
oh,
hey, you can make your bed and take out the trash and clean up after yourself. You know, whether like girls, I think just on their own, you know, jump up from dinner by the time they're out of a high chair and, you know, clean up after themselves, and boys not so much. I mean, I'm still telling my kids who are now 11 to 20, you know, hey, don't forget to clear like after every single meal.
Oh yeah.
So yeah. So I I wrote that book, which, you know, which really struck a chord, also generated a lot of hate. Like, if you look on Amazon, we have 5-star reviews or 1-star reviews from people who are just like pissed off that, you know, the whole idea of feminism and women being empowered, but, you know, other people like really got it.
Or or boys being, you know, like the idea of respect, like, you know, being for boys as well. Like, that's important.
Boys get it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, just the idea that like this is important for boys to understand because of how they're socialized. And of course they should be respecting women and respecting each other and, you know, seeing girls as equals.
And, you know, and at the same time, also like feeling comfortable expressing their emotions. Yes. Like, that was one of the other bits of research I turned up, was that boys are comfortable expressing anger, but not sadness, you know, and that's a problem too.
I think a lot of I know this has like been in the narrative a lot lately. You know, like Mr. Rogers was very big on that. And, you know, there was like a time period where it wasn't cool to be like Mr. Rogers was, you know, like they're like, oh, Mr. Rogers, he was, you know, hokey. And but, you know, I think people are starting to kind of come around again and realize that what, you know, like being like a man who was modeling for young children.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, like, the young boys are going to identify with him as well, you know, but, like, modeling, like, we can talk about emotions, we can talk about feelings, we can talk about these topics and, you know, respect enough that children have, you know, and the children, you know, and little boys can express their emotions outside of anger. I think, you know, people are obviously, because there's going to be a movie about him, but people are really coming back around from that, you know, hardened, I don't know, cynical time period. And, you know, like realizing there was a lot to that and we need more of it.
Yeah. You know, and I think the pendulum has swung and, you know, we're realizing just how important kindness is.
Yep.
Kindness and compassion and empathy. And, you know, and I realize that over these last few years, I've really kind of taken that bottom-up approach to, I don't want to say teaching, because I don't want to give the impression that my books are didactic in any way, but just sort of spreading the idea.
They're fun, but they're...
I think they're fun.
Well,
I think
done.
They're, you know, they're sweet, they rhyme, they're engaging. I mean, even my more right-leaning friends have said to me of my feminist books, they said, one friend in particular said, you know, it's not offensive at all. As if, you know, as if feminism or equality could be offensive in any way. But I got what he meant.
Right.
You know, it just makes it like, you know, as I said, like, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And, you know, and after my first book of feminism for boys, I realized we really need to publish a book for girls on feminism, and that it's a whole different book that, you know, instead of teaching respect and equality and you know, breaking the myths of toxic masculinity, it's really about sisterhood and empowerment and raising your voice and lifting up others,
which is another important thing, because a lot of times girls seem to be socialized to cut each other down, or at least that was, I don't want to say ingrained, but somehow, I mean, you know, like mean girls became canon.
Mean girls are a thing. Mean girls are a thing. I mean, and we all know it. We all,
and if you're, and you know, if that's what's being modeled for you, or, you know, you're, all you're hearing is, oh, she, you know, so-and-so is so much prettier than so-and-so, or this and that, and, you know, like, well, first of all, I mean, that kind of makes the focus on, like, your looks are who you are, but it also, like, girls internalize that as you should be cutting each other down, and, I mean, I know that sounds really harsh, but, you know,
no,
like, you should...
that looking for flaws, I agree.
Looking
in
for
that,
flaws,
you know,
looking for cracks as well,
and
which...
Yeah, no, and the point you raised about beauty also, that's something I didn't even think about or have to touch in the boys' book. I mean, boy, like, I live in a boy household. We don't have a comb. Like, none of them have mirrors, you know. They wear whatever clothing I bring home for them, you know, or that gets handed down to them from the older brother.
Right.
But, you know, in my first book of feminism, the, you know, the book that's for girls, like, there's a line that says, pretty is not your job and perfect is not a goal. Because I felt like we needed to de-emphasize beauty and looks as currency, you know, so there are 4 pages about, you know, wear whatever you want to wear and be yourself. And, you know, we made a point of showing girls of all different shapes and sizes. You know, so feminism for girls is very, very different. The vocabulary is very different. You know, whereas in the boy book, I wanted to talk about, you know, showing feelings other than anger. And, you know, you can be a teacher or a baker. You don't have to be these typically, you know, male and macho professions. Like, for girls, we had to talk about, there's a line that says, strong is not bossy and smart is not shrill. You know, embrace your intelligence, drive, and fierce will.
And great language, too.
Well, these are very, you know, particular adjectives, and there have been studies that talk about how the same attributes, like the word leader, when you use that word to describe a man, it's always seen as a positive. When you use that word to describe a woman, it's seen as a negative more often, you know, and she is considered bossy. So I think these are important, really important, like, big issues that we address in, like, this little book with simple, bold art, you know, in the hopes that when they're young and open and haven't formed impressions and there's no prejudice, that they can just really absorb these lessons.
I think you are doing wonderful things. And on behalf of moms of boys, geeky moms, and parents in general, not just moms, dads, and parents in general, of any gender, I think, you know, who like comic books, like, we owe you a huge debt, because we wanted to read these books to our kids as well. And it was great that somebody took up the initiative to begin making them accessible to both parents and children.
Oh, well, thank you. It just, you know, makes me happy if the books get read. That's all.
And
that's all I care about.
Thank you very much. Do you, before we go, do you have anything that's coming up that you'd like to tell us about?
We've gone even further in this direction of, you know, what I call my more politicized list. We have this deck called Feminist Flashcards that's coming out right now. That's a great little gift, and also just that idea of something that's fun and engaging, like, they're actual games that you can play with these flashcards, and the art is really, really hip and cool and fun. But you're learning about a mix of iconic feminists and also more obscure women who've done incredibly impressive things. And then we have a follow-up deck called Activist Flashcards that's coming out in the spring. And a great little book that I'm just finishing up, will be going on press with shortly, that's called No, My First Book of Protest. And it profiles 9 amazing activists, leaders in civil rights and women's rights. And we have, like, Greta Thunberg. We talk about climate. We talk about disability rights in a little board book for kids. That I just think is really cool and fun. You know, and I hope people will, like, check back in and
yes,
see what else we've got going on.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. Once again, this is Jessica, and I'm here with
Julie Merberg from Downtown Bookworks. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And I'm going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.